From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to a full hour of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. This is Cade Massey hosting today with my longtime collaborator, friend, co-host, faculty colleague, Eric Bradlow. Our two other co-hosts are out and about doing Shane and Audie things. They will be back sometime in the future. We are always here, almost every week of the year, some combination of us. Appreciate y'all being here. You can track us down when we're not doing the show. You can track us down on probably Twitter is the easiest way. At W Moneyball is our handle up there, at W Moneyball. We follow all of our guests. We tweet, that is, about the world of sports and sports analytics. We love to hear from you. Give us your feedback, ideas, suggestions, criticisms, love, whatever you got. We're here for it. We have a long conversation with Seth Stevens Davidowitz, the economist and author. Seth Stevens Davidowitz has a new book out on NBA analytics, which is terrifically fun and interesting for multiple reasons. So stick around for that. Eric and I have a brief window to talk about a few things around the world of sports analytics before we jump on with Seth. Eric, number one, combine, man. The combine week last week, the entire NFL gathers in Indianapolis. What jumped out to you from all the news that was coming out of Indy last week?
Just two quick things. One is, you know, now there's talk that J.J. McCarthy from Michigan, Bo Nix from Oregon have shot up the board. And now there's going to be, you know, there's this the big three quarterbacks, of course, Caleb Williams, Drake May and Jalen Daniels have always been up there. I don't know who the sixth one is besides Nix and McCarthy. But we've, in some sense, I hate to say it this way, we've got 18 years of play of Bo Nix and J.J. McCarthy. And these guys were in the college for like 20 years each. Yes. And now all of a sudden they do some stuff at the combine and they're shooting up the board. So that struck me as like, you know, I love the combine, but let's be real about it. Like, what did you really learn about J.J. McCarthy and Bo Nix that makes them, well, maybe they'll scratch the first round to now they're top 15 people. That surprised me.
Yep.
And the second was Xavier Worthy. I mean, he ran the fastest ever 40 time at the combine, 4.21. However,
Eric, I'm sorry, who do you play college ball for?
Oh, was he Texas?
Yeah.
Okay, what a shock. But here was my point. I posted something on Wharton Moneyball, and this shows you how quickly our population cares about us. Literally, as he finished it, I tweeted at W Moneyball, Xavier really runs the fastest time ever. And Ben, I forget his last name, the guy that's been on our show many times, the guy that, this, whatever, one of our not listeners, one of our guests on the show, has said,
oh, Benjamin Robinson, grind the marks.
Benjamin Robinson tweets back at me within 5 seconds. Eric, you know he only weighs 160 pounds, right?
Yeah, right?
Some sort of adjustment for the guy's weight. And then I started to look at this and think about it. So I looked, Usain Bolt, by the way, you know, at the Super Bowl 1 year, he ran the 40 in basically sweats and flip-flops without warming up. And he ran a 4.22. And Usain Bolt, I mean, the fastest man ever, but he weighs 210 pounds. The rumors, you know, the rumors, they have the film. This is like the Zapruder film. It's been analyzed so many times. Bo Jackson, they claim, ran a 4.12 40. And of course, Bo Jackson weighed at least 220. So I'm just commenting that 4.21 is really fast, but he weighs 160 pounds. So, you know, we talk about this. How much will he make it onto the field? How much can he stay on the field? He's 4.21 when he's not being hit. But what happens after he's hit a bunch? Is he going to be 4.21? Is he going to be able to, when someone bumps him at the line of scrimmage? So I was just wondering how predictive this is of his value on the field. But on the other hand, one last sentence, he creates space for other players. So from that point of view, there's going to be value.
Right. And I mean, there's other kinds of speed, right? The three cone drills and that kind of stuff.
He was in the top five of those as well. He was number one, but he was in the top five.
But you raise a great question. Like, we could do the analysis, someone could do the analysis of like some weight adjusted, because that's going to matter. Some of these fast tight ends, or speed is an important way that they distinguish themselves. But it's funny you mentioned Bo Jackson. I had a late night boozy conversation with my good buddy, Brian Ross, who played college ball, was on the field. Was at least in the stadium on the other side of the ball with Bo Jackson, and swears he was basically Superman. It led to some late night texting with an old school scout in the NFL who did some research and reported back that Bo Jackson's pro day in 1986, he ran a 4.35. Pro day, 4.35. That's at a pretty official timing And so I'm gonna go short. I'm gonna go short on the 4-1-2. Eric, another big piece of news. Caitlin Clark continues to break records, break basketball records. She just went past Pete Maravich's, I think, all time.
That's true.
Men's or women's scoring. You raise an interesting question about Maravich and Caitlin Clark.
Well, first, let's just be clear. I mean, let me start with. I love what Caitlin Clark is doing. She's the closest thing to Steph Curry as an offensive player that I've seen in a long, long time. Her range is unbelievable. Her technique is wonderful. Her balance is great. Her form is great. She actually takes really good shots. Her shot selection, I've seen a lot of analyses, is actually quite good. But she's done it in 4 years. Pete Maravich did it in three. The second thing is Pete Maravich, they've done a calculation, like he didn't have three-pointers. And so if you took an adjusted, like Pete Maravich would have had like 1,000 more points.
Oh, geez. Okay.
But my question is, if you just did an analysis of Caitlin Clark versus Pete Maravich, what would it show? Like, in other words, you could do this because my guess is because of data science now and movement data, you could have the counterfactual. What if Pete Maravich took shots from where Caitlin Clark had taken shots? What would he have scored? You know, yeah. Of course, he has to be defended by somebody, but it's not an impossible counterfactual that one could try to assess right now.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Using movement data. But again, we should not diminish her accomplishments, which have been just truly, truly remarkable. And apparently she has another year of eligibility. I doubt she's going to come back.
No, she's announced. She's announced that she's moving. Eric, just real quickly, your analysis suggestion ties back again to the Bo Jackson conversation. We started speculating that the game has surely gotten faster. And those who played against Bo Jackson and report how extraordinarily fast he was were probably norming him against a different set of players. And now we have the technology to go into videotape and we could actually assess his speed because we can look at speed now in videos and Absolutely. Translate it 40 times. And we could also look at the game's speed and in some sense calculate his, you love the term exceedance, calculate the difference between him and his peers relative to the Xavier Worthies of the world today and their peers to get a sense of how much he stood out. This is kind of what you always want to do. Eric, we have about a minute to go. We want to touch on baseball. You mentioned the home run totals, betting on home run totals, top three in the league, Acuna 43, Judge 40, Otani 38. Fun speculation on who looks good with the long ball this year. What are your thoughts on those numbers?
Just quickly, since we only have a minute, I'm taking the over on two out of the three of them, but I'm not sure I can tell you which two of the three. I'd love to say okay. All three, but you guys have taught me not to do that. And base rates, so I'm not taking over on all three. Okay. I'll just say the following. We talked about this last week in just a quick comparison. I would do more shrinkage on home runs because they're rarer events with smaller sample sizes than I would on wins.
Oh,
and so that to me is an interesting comparison. I would shrink home runs back more from my prediction and less on win totals.
Okay. How do you feel about Otani? He's not going to be pitching this year, right? So does that give us more confidence in his home run totals?
It don't hurt.
Right.
I feel better about it. I feel better than following. He's likely to get the number of at-bats you would expect as for someone that's not going to be as injured. Absolutely.
Okay. Good fun. All right. Super quick. Little NFL, a little hoops, and a little baseball. Now let's roll over to a long conversation with Seth. We'll dive in more. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to the second half of this week's show. As you guys know, our second half is usually our guest segment, and it is again this week. Along with my co-host, Eric Bradlow, we have a first-time guest, Seth Stevens-Davidowitz, is joining us this week. We know Seth. We've known Seth for a number of years now. In fact, he visited as a professor here a number of years ago in my home department of Operations, Information, and Decisions. Delighted to have Seth back. He's a data scientist. He's an economist with a PhD in economics from Harvard. He's an author. He has a best-selling book called Everybody Lies, as well as a new book. He's got a second one. What's the second one floating around here? Help me out, Seth.
Don't Trust Your Gut.
Don't Trust Your Gut. After Everybody Lies, he wrote a book called Don't Trust Your Gut. And he has a third book out, which is what we want to talk about today, entitled Who Makes the NBA? It is a deep dive into analytics to answer some fun and interesting questions about the NBA. And he writes it in an intriguing way. Lots to talk about with Seth. Thanks for making time, Seth, and welcome to Wharton Moneyball.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. Yeah, I miss you. I remember showing up at Wharton. I think my little office was across the way from yours, and we'd talk about what happened in the football the week before. I remember.
No, don't tell them that. We were talking about deep questions about, I don't know, global health or something. Yeah, we might have had a few football conversations. Seth, listen, the conceit for this book is an intriguing one. It sounds like late last summer you're playing around with AI and you challenge yourself to two ways. Write a book in 30 days, which if you hadn't already been a two-time author, that might have been too cheeky, but this is a nice challenge for a multiple book author. Write a book in 30 days and do an analytics book using AI as your basically RA, essentially. You weren't going to do the coding. You're going to use AI. Do I have that right? And how did the setup come about? What motivated you for this challenge in particular?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I started playing around with this tool. It's called Code Interpreter. Now it's called Data Analysis from OpenAI, kind of through ChatGPT Plus. I always have to give the caveat. I have no affiliation with OpenAI because I sound like a pitch man for them. I'm like, you got to see this product. But it was amazing. And I just started noticing that things that used to take me 4 months were taking me 4 hours. Like data analysis. And it was just wild. I'm like, oh my God, this is the most insane product I've ever seen. And like my whole work stream was totally different. So I tried to kind of calculate. Usually my books take me about 3 years because, you know, they're intensive deep dives, original research. And I was trying to calculate how long I thought I could write what I consider a good book. And I thought I could write one in 30 days. So that kind of made it fun too, because it's kind of like, could I actually do it in 30 days? And I'm so happy with how it turned out. Like my previous two books, every time I open the page, I want to vomit. I'm like, how did I let that paragraph in? Like that chart's all wrong or whatever. This time I'm like rereading it. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to say.
Really,
So I was
really,
really happy with how it turned out.
that's fascinating. But what's your attribution for that? My parsimonious, boring answer is that it's your third book. You've gotten better at this. Is there a more elaborate answer than that?
Maybe I think so. It was very clear early on that I was going to have to self-publish it, that no publisher was on board with my 30-day project.
Right,
And
right.
I think that freed me a little bit. You know, a lot of my friend just messaged me. He said, "Seth, I was blown away by this book. And just in case you think I'm lying, I did not feel that way about your first two books." Which I'm like,
That
is that okay? Should I be happy, sad
Yeah,
about that?
that's a mixed one. That's a mixed
Yeah.
one, but
But what he said was that there was no fluff in this book.
yeah.
That like it was just kind of the facts, the charts. And I think when you go with a traditional publisher, you feel the pressure to make it seem prestigious, and you know, you gotta like use the big words and the tell the story and follow the formula. And for this book, I'm just like, here's the question, here's the chart, here's the answer, here's what it means. And I feel like that's kind of how I want books to be, but I kind of felt free to do that with this book in a way I didn't with my previous books.
Eric.
Yeah, so Seth, I have a bunch of, let's call them quick questions with, let's just do a rapid fire round here with 15 second answers that relate to your book. So
Sure.
first of all, did you use ChatGPT Plus to, after you had written a draft of something, you inserted it and asked it to clean it up or anything? Could you use it for proofreading slash suggestions on writing?
Proofreading, yes. Suggestions on writing, no, not at all. I think ChatGPT is like a B writer, and you know, I'd like to think I'm an A or hopefully an A plus writer. So the writing, not at all. The only thing I did is I have an appendix where I say how I used ChatGPT in the process, and I allowed ChatGPT to write that appendix.
Okay.
So I did exactly what you said. I put a little like a rough outline. And then I said, "Here, ChatGPT, make this cleaner, make this more organized." I'm like, the appendix is really doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't have to be very well written. It just has to be kind of well structured, organized. So even people who read my girlfriend hates basketball, so she like skipped the appendix, and she's like, "Well, maybe I'll find this interesting." And then she's like, "The writing is not that good." And I'm like, "Yeah, it was just ChatGPT who wrote the
Let
appendix."
me go to my second one. Did you use ChatGPT to do data collection? And if yes, after you collected the data, did you validate it at all in any way?
Yeah, so ChatGPT is not connected to the internet, so you can't do straight up scraping the websites, but you can do saving a website and then helping you find a chart. It's a little complicated. And then you always have to check to make sure that it did it right. I'm going a little over 15 seconds,
No,
but
that's
one of the
fine.
things that happens when you use ChatGPT is you kind of learn where you have to double check and where you can just let it rip. So over time, you kind of know where it's likely to make mistakes and where it's and you do have to do the double check and the validation, and where you're like, okay, you can just rely on it. Kind of like using an RA, I guess.
Okay. And once you had data from various sources, did you have it, whether it's fit a regression, a machine learning model, a neural net, draw a graph? Like, what kinds of analyses did you find it very good at doing?
Oh yeah, 100%. That was I it did all of that. I didn't do any. I just talked to it, merge the data set, clean the data set, run this analysis, take out this sample and see how that changes it, make the chart. And it was just crazy. It was useful. Like just a lot of little things. Kate, maybe, you guys might know one of the charts, it's where NBA players went to college over time. So could, and I have a lit, I have a chart in Kentucky, Duke, Michigan State, UCLA, other college. And then I just tell ChatGPT, make it all the colors of the college. And then in a second, Kentucky's blue, Duke's the slightly different blue, North Carolina's the light blue, Michigan State's green, and things like that. Just, that would have taken me, an hour. It took me a minute. And you add up all these little changes, it's wild how quick the whole process is.
It would have taken you more than an hour. And the
Yeah.
example that really jumped out to me, what this is such a minor thing, but it's something that I've run into throughout my career. You gave the example of telling it to make sure the labels don't overlap on some
Yeah.
chart. It's like sometimes I don't use labels because I know how to manually make them not overlap, but it's going to be a long time, like customizing the position of every label. You can just tell it to not do that. It's like freaking fantastic.
And it's not just the time saving process. I think because it's so easy, you just don't get tired to the same degree. So, if I'm fixing a chart or even working with an RA to fix a chart and emailing them and then it comes back and it's wrong and oh my God, do this, do that. You do that for a few hours and you're like, God, I gotta, take a break. Like, I need to clear my mind. And when the AI is doing everything for you, it's just, you just don't get tired in the same way. So you can do a lot more.
It's super interesting. Let's come back to that topic. Let's talk a little bit about the book and the content of the book, and then come back to the methodology. I do think the methodology is one of the main things we need to talk about in this interview, because we know that AI is going to change the way that data analysis happens. And in many ways, it's going to democratize data analysis. And we have seen data analysis blow up and sports analytics blow up in our past 10 years. We've been on the show exactly 10 years now. What happens next is going to be hugely AI influenced. And I think your book stands as such an interesting example of that. In fact, I think your book is a terrific primer to people who want to use AI in data analysis, and kids or even, 40-year-olds who want to get into the world. I think it's more open to them than ever before. And if for a simple demonstration of that, chase down this book. But let's talk a little bit about content. We'll circle back to methodology in a minute. Let's talk a little bit about content. It's called Who Makes the NBA? And in fact, some of the chapters are about who makes the NBA, but not all the chapters are about it, who makes the NBA. Some of them are just like interesting questions about the NBA. You're a big NBA fan. We're NBA fans. And it's fun to go through this and just see the not just the questions you ask, because you ask good ones, but also your analysis. And even though it's quick, like your friend said, not a lot of fluff, but it still has nuance. This is one of the great things about reading someone as sophisticated as you are quantitatively, you're going to bring nuance. And so I want to raise, you have 10 chapters in here, each a different question. I want to raise just a couple, and I'm sure it can take us to other parts of the book. Let's just focus on three real quick. Number one is height adjusting players. This is a fun exercise. It's kind of a silly exercise at some level, but it's provocative. So what Seth does here is he's like, look, some people are more successful in the NBA because they're taller. Let's do something that we're forever trying to do in sports analytics, which is like, let's normalize for some factor. Except in this case, he's going to normalize for a physical factor, your height. What happens if we normalize for people's height, players' height, and then evaluate them? Like, What do we see? So can you talk a little bit about this and what you learned from doing this? And tell us about the, well, I don't know how much of a story we need, but your acronym for these, the unit you used was Muggsies, named after someone who emerges at the top of your chart.
Well, and the fun thing about that is another great use of ChatGPT. I had I need to name this metric, and I named it Muggsies. I'm like, it'd be great if it was an acronym, or I guess it's called a backronym, apparently. It'd be fun if it was if it stood for something, but I'm not great at coming up with things it would stand for. So I asked ChatGPT, and it came up with Muggsies stands for metric for understanding game given sporting individuals' effectiveness and size, which is just perfect, like
It's absurd.
amazing. That's like
Right.
so good. I would have never come up with that in a million
You know why
years.
you wouldn't have come up with it? Because you never would have referred to a player as a sporting individual.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it's just not in my head, but it works.
It worked. Okay, so tell us about Muggsies
And
and tell us what
first of
emerges.
all, the motivation is just, I think people realize obviously height is important in the NBA. You kind of have to be blind not to realize that tall people are disproportionately NBA players. But I think people don't realize just how much it matters. So each inch roughly doubles your chances of making the NBA throughout the height distribution. So if you're 6 feet tall, you have twice the chance as if you're 5'11". If you're 6'1", you have twice the chance if you're 6 feet. All the way, if you're 7 feet, you have twice the chance as if you're 6'11". What this means is if you're 7 feet or above, you have something like a 1 in 7 chance of reaching the NBA, which is just
Now,
insane.
I've
Like,
heard that, by the way, I've heard
yeah.
that stat before. Just to be clear, this is amongst the general population of all people in the world. Like, it's not like if I took all college players, this is it's an important question for our listeners here on Wharton Moneyball. If I took all college players, it wouldn't be that extreme, right?
No, if you took all college players, it would be more extreme. So it's
You
one
think
in
so?
seven in the population. So if you got the people who already became a college
No, no,
player
no,
and they're
no. But
7 feet
my
tall.
comment is, let's say, I just want to make sure you mentioned doubling. So there's 12 height inches between 6 feet and 7 feet. If it's a doubling, it would be 2 raised to the power 12, which would be something like 1 in like 4,000 to 1. It's not 4,000 times more likely that a 7-footer in college will make the court than a
Oh, okay,
six footer
yes.
in college.
So once you've already reached
That's what I
college,
mean.
exactly. So that would correct it.
Yes.
You'd be corrected to some extent. So the 6 foot player in college has already proven themselves in a way, so would have a chance,
That's what I
a
was
better
referring
chance.
to.
Yeah, exactly.
Seth, before we go any further, let me real quickly play a little game with Eric, because Eric has not yet read the book, but he knows more about the NBA than I do. Eric, and this is, we're going to go right at the most provocative thing here.
All right.
You know, everybody knows who most people consider the greatest basketball player of all time, and certainly of our generation. So we're all biased that way, Michael Jordan. Where on Seth's new list, top 10 height adjusted or lower, top 10 height adjusted, top height adjusted players in NBA history, where do you think Michael Jordan ends up? Michael Jordan was 6'6", by the way.
That's interesting because he was so great and he's not overly tall. So he's got to be somewhere in the top five.
He comes in at
That
nine. He comes
that's
in at
a
nine.
that's a
That's
perfect
not.
answer because you come and ask where Kareem Abdul-Jabbar ranks.
Yeah,
Yeah,
right.
so Kareem, one could easily argue, is the greatest player of all time. I would argue, same number of championships as Jordan, more MVPs than Jordan, one with two different teams. I could say lots of things. Obviously, had more rebounds, etc. Kareem has to be, I don't know, 40. I don't know.
No, 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 no. He's 7'2", and just consider the advantages you have versus the shorter guys. He comes in at space 2,244. Seth takes Kareem down. The
Wow.
legend of Bill Russell goes down 1,419. I mean, Seth's brutal on these guys. I mean, it's kind of a, Seth might be, vertically challenged himself. It may be a big revenge play. I don't know.
I enjoyed it as a 5'9" passionate basketball player who never even made it to my freshman basketball team. There was a little bit of revenge of the short person here. But one of the things you
Okay.
see in
Hold on. Is
basketball,
Tiny Archibald number one?
no, Muggsy.
I was going to say Muggsy. That was going to be my other
Yeah.
guess. Okay, Aaron, well, see, at 5'3", right? But let me ask you another question. Of currently active players, who do you think's highest on the list? There is a well-known currently active player who's highest on the list. What's that?
Steph Curry.
How tall is Steph?
Like 6'2".
You get a lot of action. He's probably coded as taller than that. He get a lot of action off of height here. Keep going. You got it. In fact, you don't have to go very far from Seth.
I don't know. It's somebody on the Warriors.
Who's the shortest top player on the Warriors right now? He hasn't been on there very long, to be fair.
The shortest top. Oh, Chris Paul.
Chris
Yeah.
Paul, number
Yeah,
two on the
6 feet.
list. Number two on the list.
So one of the things that you see in the data that I also put, I have a whole bunch of charts of this, is this kind of gets to the point that Kareem height adjusted is not that great, and some of these players are ranked much lower. Is among NBA players, there is a shocking negative relationship between height and ability on anything else. So height and vertical leap, how high you can get off the ground. The taller players just leap way less than the shorter players. Height and speed, three quarters court ran at the combine, huge. That'll be a positive. Just much slower. The taller players much slower. Height and free throw percentage. Height and 3-point percentage. Height even and how much you can bench press. This was shocking that the taller players bench press less than the shorter players. And the reason for this is you just don't have to be as good because you get this height is such an advantage that if you're 6 feet tall in the NBA, if you're Chris Paul, you're competing with millions, tens of millions of other men for your spot.
So I don't know if he's technically 7 foot, but is Kevin Durant the greatest 7 footer that's ever played?
Yeah,
You
that
didn't
would be
do
a good
that.
question. I
Right,
didn't do
you
that
could within
analysis
bands. You could do it within bands.
within
Because
bands. It
he
would
would
be.
be, yeah, he would be up there for me because as you, I just use your Seth, your description. The man could really shoot free throws. The man could really shoot threes. He's not that slow. He's actually a good defensive player. He blocks a lot of shots. I would imagine his effective field goal percentage is extremely high. And he's, barely, if let's call him 7 feet. So at least he's not 7'3" or 4", like Artis Gilmore was or somebody like that, or Manute Bol.
But my guess is even these, even Kevin Durant, when you get the pure physical skills, the speed and the vertical leap, it's probably still not as high as some of these 6 footers. You just have to be so good, let alone to be Muggsy and be in the NBA for 14 seasons at 5'3". But just to be a 6-foot-tall NBA player,
Yep.
the level of athletic talent, I mean, these guys are, approaching great sprinters in speed, and they have a vertical leap that approaches a great high jumper, and they have amazing shooters, and just 7 footers don't have to be that. And one thing that's interesting is I think a lot of people think that there's something biomechanical that makes like 7 footers, worse than various things. And a bunch of people said this on Twitter, and I'm like, can you find any evidence for this? And there's no evidence that's true. I think the reason it's true, the reason we think this is because the only time we see 7 footers try to do something athletic is when we watch NBA basketball, and we're like, these guys are so much worse and less coordinated than the 6 foot players, but that's just a selection effect because they don't have to be as coordinated because they have this advantage of being 7 foot tall.
So let me just ask a quick related question. Is their height trajectory over time related to this? Like if someone was 6 foot up until age 18 and then all of a sudden grew 10 to 12 inches, so they had to work on their skills in their high school years because they weren't the 7 footer. Would there be any relation there, or that's not something you've looked at?
I haven't looked at it. I know there's a theory of that, some of the greatest players did go on late growth spurts and play like point guards more. I think Giannis might be in that category. I'm not exactly sure, but I've heard that, but I didn't look at it. I don't think there's great data on people's height through childhood or high school or anything
There was a
that I'm aware
famous,
of.
I think there's a labor economics study that shows that your men's height is related to lifetime income, but it's your height at age 16,
I've seen that,
which is a
yeah.
developmental thing.
So
But what?
it's
So
all
you're
confidence,
it's
basically.
something about confidence and maybe some social stuff. The height over time question. There's a different time wrinkle in here, Eric, and that is a late adjustment that Seth didn't make but talked about. That the league has gotten taller over time. And so really he needs to norm his list for contemporaries, essentially. And that's going to bring back some of the guys who are taller, like Steph, than comparable players at a
Yeah,
previous
like
generation. But
Bill Sharman or whatever was very high on the list. And I think everyone's like, there's no way he's the top 10 height adjusted player of all time. And he does benefit from playing so long ago.
This is a great example of like you put the analysis, you did a lot of thought, put your analysis out there, and then you iterate based on feedback and you
Yeah,
refine.
exactly.
Let's move to another one. So I'm just going to note the selection effects. Such a great, so much on selection effects, and Seth's emphasis is selection effects, kind of an economics it's really kind of an economics take on things. The choking chapter is awesome because we talk a lot about choking, and you know, there's always an open question about is clutchiness a thing? And you use free throw shooting to kind of get at this. So tell us about what you found in free throw shooting clutching.
Yeah, so it's really hard to measure clutch shooting because, you know, so many shots are different. So, you know, Kobe Bryant has a very low percentage of last second shots, but a lot of times he takes crazy shots because he never passed the ball at the end of games. So he'd take these wild three pointers and they're very low field goal percentage. Is that because he was nervous or he can't handle the pressure or just because the shots were worse? And free throws are a great way to test this because it's the same, you know, the same distance, no defender. And you can compare, you know, what happens in a clutch moment, 5 minutes or less to go in the game, within 5 points to other free throws. And you see the average NBA player shoots about 1 percentage point worse in clutch moments and about 1.8 percentage points in clutch worse in clutch moments in playoff games. And that's true controlling for fatigue in various ways you control for it.
That's what I was going to ask you, if you controlled for fatigue.
Yeah. And one of the things that it's kind of surprising because one of the great, you know, moneyball revolutions in baseball is kind of getting rid of the idea of clutch performance in general, either positive or negative. And one of the ideas is to get to the top of a league, you know, to reach the majors, the professionals, you have to be so good, so mentally tough that you can't really be a choker, right? If you're a choker, you're not going to make it probably to college, let alone the pros, if you can't handle pressure. But in the NBA, I think it's very clear that there is such a thing as choking. And I tried to figure out what is it about the chokers versus the non-chokers, because there are a whole bunch of players who are exactly the same in clutch moments and not clutch moments.
Well, so Seth, this is, don't run too quickly past this point. The average is a 1 percentage decrement in performance, but there's heterogeneity. And you point out that some people no decrement at all, and then some are really choking, essentially. And so
enormous. So some players just absolutely zero difference between their, you know, how they perform during the during clutch moments and non-clutch moments. Then you have players like Vin Baker, who has, I think, was 16 percentage points worse in the clutch than non-clutch. Tim Duncan surprised some people, very big drop in clutch moments. David Robinson had a big drop in clutch moments. Arvydas Sabonis, you kind of see a whole bunch of players where the difference is just enormous. And I was trying to figure out what is it about these players. And I tested a million theories. I even tested their family backgrounds. You know, there's a theory, Jimmy Butler, who's amazing in the clutch by my metric or just about any metric. Jimmy Butler is so good in the clutch moments because he had such a difficult childhood. So I don't know if people know the story of Jimmy Butler. His dad abandoned the family when he was young. His mom abandoned him as well. So he's abandoned by both parents. He's just been through a horrible situation, you know, terrible neighborhood, drugs, crime, everything. And there's an idea that once he's been through that, who the hell cares that millions of people are watching you shooting a free throw? You know, once you've been through that, you'll be through anything. Well, it turns out family background does not influence clutch shooting. The only thing I could find that influenced clutch shooting was height, a huge statistically significant effect that taller players, I mentioned Tim Duncan, Arvydas Sabonis, David Robinson, Vin Baker, much worse clutch shooters. And I think it follows directly from the value of height in the NBA that, again, because height is such an advantage, you just don't have to be as good at everything else. So if you were 6 foot tall and you couldn't shoot in the clutch, you would not make the NBA. There are just too many other 6 feet tall people out there who are good in the clutch who will take your spot. If you're 7 foot tall, 7'1", 7'2", 7'3", you're just competing against dozens of men. You don't have to be the most mentally tough person on the planet. You don't have to be remarkably able to handle pressure. So it was an enormous difference that the average 6 foot or below player shoots clutch free throws and non-clutch free throws at exactly the same rate. The average 7 foot or above player shoots clutch free throws at 6.8 percentage points worse than non-clutch moments. So just a huge difference. And you know, I know this as a lifelong New York Knicks fan. I mean, it was a joke how bad Patrick Ewing was in the clutch. I mean, it's laughable.
I want to note the similarity between the story that you investigated that didn't pan out versus the story that you find panning out. And that is what they had to survive and fight through in order to get to where they are. I mean, the tough childhood is a version of that same story, right? It's like they came through tough circumstances. Well, competing as a 6-footer through high school, you know, college, pro, that's the same kind of tough struggle. It has the same selection effects that economists will be looking for. Eric.
That's great.
Well, I was just going to make a comment, which Kay just made, and then I do have a question for you. But my comment was going to be, wow, you sound, and this is in a positive way I'm saying this, you sound like an economist. I mean, this is the classic selection story that economists study all the time. And so, first of all, that's good. That it shows that you're reflecting your training and your work and your writing. My question for you is, when you said the number 1% and then 1.8%, I'll use the Yiddish expression here. That sounds like bupkis to me. I understand it's an average and there's heterogeneity. Like, if so, like, here's my question. Of all the things you could have somebody work on, suppose I could say to you, you know, you shoot 75% from the line in the first 43 minutes of the game, and the last 5 minutes of the game when the game's close, you shoot 73%. Or I could make you turn over the ball less. Or I could make you pass the ball better. Or I could make you give up less offensive rebounds. Or I could make you foul less. Where do you think this effect size would fit into the things of, I need to see what predicts winning and how large is this compared to the other factors?
It's a great question, Eric. I think one of the things I'd say is I assume this is a proxy for inability to handle pressure more generally. So the fact that someone is 1 percentage point worse in free throws, they're also more likely to turn over the ball, also more likely to accidentally step on the line and go out of bounds.
As a statistician and someone that worked for ETS for years, this is exactly the kind of thing we're interested in. Is there a single unidimensional scale for clutchness, or is it more multidimensional? Kate obviously works a lot with both people analytics and training. This is the same question that people ask in lots of different domains.
So I didn't test it. One of the frustrating things when you're a huge basketball fan is it's very hard to be fully done with a book because you answer 10 questions and you have 10 more questions that you want to look at. So one of the things I'm interested in is...
That's a good problem.
Yeah, it's a good problem. But you know, I'd love to look at, does this correlate with other measures of clutch performance? But those would be a lot harder to measure in various ways. But my guess is that someone who is bad at free throws, also bad at shooting threes, also more likely to turn the ball over in the last second. The other thing about basketball is the last minutes of the game really do count a lot more than the first minutes of the game. You see this in if you watch the odds on games. So if you know someone, if a team's ahead, let's say the teams were the game was pick 'em before the game started, and then at halftime, one team's ahead by 10 points. If each minute counted equally, they'd now be 10-point favorites going forward, right? Like to win in the final, at the end of the game, they're up by 10. The teams were evenly matched. We'd expect them to win by 10 points. If you actually look at the spread, they're more like 4 or 5-point favorites at this point. So those first minutes just have a hugely less value in basketball. Teams tend to be able to catch up, you know, for whatever reason. The last moments of the game just really do have much more value in basketball. So I do think clutch shooting, ability to handle pressure would be a place I put a lot of emphasis.
All right, let's go to the third and final example from the book for this discussion anyway, and that was coaching. I think it may be the last chapter of the book where you ask, are some coaches making a bigger difference than others? And it's a fun chapter in general because you even allude to research that compares the impact of coaches across a major professional sport. And you echo the conclusion others have had, which is that NBA coaches make the biggest difference.
Well,
go ahead.
It's actually interesting. I'd be curious, as you guys in the space of sports analytics, I'm surprised the relative energy that goes into measuring the players and the coaches in analytics. Like, it's kind of surprising. I mean, there's so much energy into measuring, you know, how we can really measure a player's contribution in every sport. And you compare that, you know, you look up very quickly a player in any sport. Now there are all kinds of advanced analytics, value over replacement player, et cetera. If you look up coaches, it's basically win percentage, and that's about it. There's so much less emphasis. It kind of seems like a ripe area for me for sports analytics to go into. I'd be curious what you think about that.
We're 100% with you. Coaching analytics, we love it anytime we see it. It's one of the reasons I'm picking the chapter to talk about briefly. It's challenging, obviously. And a lot of times the field hasn't gotten there yet. We usually just kind of throw everything we can't model into ERA or, you know, the residual And the a lot of coaching models you see are just taking the residual. And so, yeah, the coaches are in there somewhere, but so is a lot of other stuff. And turn it around, my collaborator, longtime friend, former student Rufus Peabody will say about, you know, NFL analytics, once you've got a really good model for a team's performance, it's not like coaching just lives outside of that. A lot of the coaching is going through the factors that you have in your model. And so it really is hard to separate. One of the things I liked about the NBA analysis you did was that at the professional level, at least you're parsing out, you don't have team selection, you know, at least not as much about team selection. You're going to parse it directly by controlling for the quality of the players. In college sports, recruiting plays such an important role that his impact or her impact might go through as much player selection and retention as it does actual performance. But tell us what you find, because you weren't actually asking how much. You were like, which ones of these coaches were the best and how big it is?
Yeah, so I used a method that I found on a blog. One of the things, the great things about sports analytics is frequently the best methods are on blogs, not in peer-reviewed research. That happens over and over again. Just great. Oh, for sure. So many passionate people about it. And there was a blogger, Ramzi Alamin, who basically tried to measure the value of coaches by, let's say, how good the players were the year before they played for the coach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then we have a kind of a sense of how good, how much talent they are. I extended a little more because I didn't really understand why should you just do the year before they played for the coach. I used all information you had on other years. And another addition I made was adjust for age. Because if the player, you know, a year before was 20 and now they're 21, well, we'd expect them to be improving. And, you know, so first I just said, how much does age impact whatever advanced analytic you use, win shares per 48 or value over replacement? You know, what's the correlation with age? Then correct for that and say, how good were the players on average before they came to the team to say, okay, how much talent did this team have? Is it a perfect measure? No. There are issues. Tim Duncan played his entire career with Greg Popovich. There are some players who just were going to improve anyway. Maybe Michael Jordan was, you know, he wasn't as great age adjusted before Phil Jackson came. Was that really entirely due to Phil Jackson, or was he just on the verge of superstardom anyway? It's hard to know for sure. So I don't think it's a perfect measure, but it does still say that coaches are really valuable. And I think my number one, some of the coaches that come up really high, Stan Albeck, Jerry Sloan, Phil Jackson, Greg Popovich, Larry Bird, because Larry Bird's short tenure with the Pacers, they just did not have a lot of objective talent on those teams, and they did really well. So that was interesting that he scores so highly.
Jumps out.
Mm-hmm. It jumps out because, you know, we don't usually think of him as a legendary coach. It was such a short period.
Well, also, he came and went so quickly.
Yeah,
only man in the history of the NBA to win player MVP, coach MVP, and general manager of the year MVP. Larry Bird.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. And then Doug Moe, who wasn't even that great. His teams weren't that great. But I think he barely over .500 winning percentage. But if you look at the talent on the team, very little talent that he did a lot with. And then, you know, one of the things that happens with this analysis is a lot of the coaches that had very high win percentages, like the recent short-term coaches for the Boston Celtics, Joe Mazzulla, and they go down a lot because the Boston Celtics clearly had a lot of talent. You know, David Blatt has a 67.5% winning percentage. I think it's the sixth highest win percentage of the modern era. Well, he coached LeBron James, so he comes at using this adjusting for player talent. He comes up as an average or even below average coach because the formula shows, okay, LeBron was already an amazing player before he showed up. But I think one of the things that I really found interesting about doing this is, okay, let's say we have a measure. It may not be perfect. We have some metric to measure coaches, how many wins a coach adds on a season, which I think is very high. Other scholars have found
very high. Let's play the game one more time. And Eric, this has put you in a really tough spot, but you're up for challenges. So Eric, he's about to tell you he does some analysis to figure out what they do differently. Like, what is it that these most successful coaches do differently from the other guys? If you had to spin out some hypotheses, what are some that you would spin?
Good question. It would be probably whether it's, I'll call it a consistent rotation, or it's distribution of minutes, or it's Something about maybe it's the right interaction of players playing together. Those would be my top three theories.
Yeah, I actually tested those and they came out as not that important, in part because they're kind of small. Like every coach knows their best player, right? No coach is going to coach LeBron James and not play him a certain amount of minutes or, you know, so I think that, you know, not play Jokic enough or not play the real stars that had a lot of wins. So that seemed to not have a big
No.
impact.
I wasn't referring necessarily to the best. I was referring to like, what does the coach do with players like 4 through 8 on the team? Like, it's clear. Like,
Yeah, but
how much? Yeah.
I think that then that makes a small that has a smaller impact in part because they're not usually playing in the clutch moments, which are
Right.
really much more important in the game. So it seems like that's not
Okay.
a huge difference. There was so that there I test a whole bunch of things. A lot of them didn't correlate. There was one thing that correlated enormously strong, and it was a very interesting thing that you could do very quickly with ChatGPT, is kind of speaking as an economist, you do kind of a fixed effects model on a metric of how often a player passes the ball when they're driving to the basket. And then you have, this is how much a player on average passes the ball. Here's how much they pass the ball when they're coached by this player. So again, it takes advantage of the fact that they weren't always coached by the player. So when the player is not coached by this person, they pass 60% of the time. Now they're passing 68% of the time. But you're using a regression and you're kind of finding the effects of coaches. And the effects of coaching there is enormous. Some coaches, players are just much more likely to pass the ball when they're driving the basket. And that was enormously correlated with coaching success. Now, it gets back to a statement famously made by Isaiah Thomas to Bill Simmons. He said, "The secret of basketball is it's not about basketball." And what does that mean? Basketball has more than almost any other sport an incentives problem. Because what you see in basketball, and a lot of players have pointed this out, is the more points you score, generally the more money you're going to earn. So it shows up in salaries, but it also really shows up. I did an analysis with Facebook fans, how many Facebook fans a player has. And the only predictor of that is how many points per game they score. Like how much anything else is just irrelevant. Their field goal percentage, their assists, their defense, it's all irrelevant. It's how many points they score. So basketball is this problem where players have an incentive to take as many shots as possible, even if they're hitting them at low percentages. And the great coaches, I believe, one of the main things a great coach does is they're able to get the players to act in the interest of the team, possibly at their own expense. It's kind of like being a great military leader. You're trying to get the players to think about their team more than themselves. And it's actually very interesting. If you look at the biographies of great coaches, there's a great book, The Culture Code by Daniel Coyne. And he profiles Greg Popovich, who comes out by my metric as a great coach, by just about any metric as a great coach. And they kind of say, what does he do? And it's very interesting how little of it is spent on the things that Eric was suggesting, you know, studying how much every player should play or, you know, X's and O's. So much of it is just building the culture and getting the players to become a family of sorts. So, you know, he'll take them out to these dinners and he'll talk about, what about your childhood? Tell me about your childhood. Giving them all hugs. Like it's kind of sounds corny, but I think it's so important in basketball that the players are able to basically do what may not be the best in their interest. If a player wants to maximize their career earnings, they want to be that crazy shooter, you know, scoring as many points as they can. They'll get a lot of fans. They'll get endorsement deals. They'll probably get a higher salary. And I think the great coaches are able to get the players to do much less of that.
So obviously, Eric, we gave you a very difficult question because nobody was ever going to come up with they get their players to pass more. But there and obviously Seth's bringing a lot of storytelling to his data analysis. He's matching some good data analysis with some serious storytelling. But it's a wonderful, now it's basically a hypothesis that people can pursue going forward. And
Exactly.
I think it's super intriguing. And I mean, there is this fundamental tension in group performance between individual accomplishment and sacrificing for the team. And this goes to the heart of that. All right, we have to stop there. We could go on forever. We could do the whole show with Seth on this. Seth, on the way out, give those of us who want to start playing with AI for data analysis, or maybe especially beginners in data analysis, give them just a little bit of guidance on where they should go, what they should do to take advantage of the tools that you used in writing this book. And again, I just want to recommend the book itself as a place to go. Who makes the NBA 2023, 2024, Seth? What year is
end
it?
End of 2023.
It was 2023.
2023. Yeah.
Seth Stevens Davidowitz. It's a fantastic, it's a great read on NBA. It's a very interesting read on data analytics, but it's especially new and provocative and helpful, I think, on ChatGPT and AI in generals as a portal into data analysis. Your thoughts, Seth?
Yeah. So, Kate, at the end of the book, I have an appendix. That's how nerdy I am. My books have appendices at the end of it, where I talk about it, how you can best use these tools. But one of my main pieces of advice is just use the tool. So use data analysis. It's again, I'm not affiliated with OpenAI. It's $30 a month. And I learned so much over time. You start getting a sense of here's where the AI is likely to mess up. Here's where the AI is likely to do a good job. Here's what I can expect it to do. Here's what I can't expect it to do. The best way to learn is learning by doing, and just get in the habit of using it for your data analysis. And I think you'll be shocked by the time saved in the process and the things that it can do. I think it really blew me away. It continues to this day to blow me away. I'm thinking of writing an Olympics book before the Summer Olympics, and I'm playing around with AI tools. It's so fun.
You got 3 months. You could write three Olympics books.
Yeah, three Olympics books. Maybe a summer and a winter one. I don't know.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, Seth, so the appendix itself is worth it for those who are interested, because he's got multiple, but the appendix on AI, because it's all these different elements of coding data, organizing data, visualizing data, running inference on data, lots of alternatives, lots of ways in for you. Okay, we have to go. This has been a lot of fun, son. Seth, thanks, man, for making time. Wish you the best. Why don't you tell people the best way to find the book? It's self-published. How hard is it for people to find?
No, Who Makes the MBA on Amazon. Just search Who Makes the MBA on Amazon, and you should be able to get a copy pretty easily.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. That is Seth Stevens Davidowitz, data scientist, economist, author. He's got his third book out now. First-time guest on Wharton Moneyball. Great talking to you, Seth. Great to see you.
Thanks so much for having me, Cade and Eric.
All right, man. That has been another hour, another show here on Wharton Moneyball. Appreciate you guys making it an hour with us. For my co-host, Eric Bradlow, for our two co-hosts in absentia, Shane Jensen and Adi Weiner, for our boss man producer, Maddie Datz, for our associate boss man, Dion Simpkins, for Kelly the intern, making things happen. Appreciate y'all listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.